Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Remembering D-Day and the Allied invasion of Normandy 70 years ago tomorrow is also a reminder of the role members of the Greatest Generation played in defeating fascism. We talked about D-Day on Monday's program. Today we talk with a man who was there, one who wrote about area military men who were there and elsewhere, and with an airman who flew missions over World War II Europe. Joining me in studio, Clem Igel ended World War II as a sergeant after his D-Day landing. He helped liberate Paris, fighting in the Battle of the Bulge, and helped protect the bridge at Remagen, a key route to the German heartland. Dr. George Despotis is co-author of Victory Through Valor, a series of oral histories of World War II vets, including many from this region. He is also associate professor of pathology, immunology, and anesthesiology at Washington University. Also with us is Harris Gerhardt. He was a B-24 bomber flight engineer who flew 32 missions over Europe during the last 6 months of the war. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you. Clem, I'm going to start with you.
Go ahead. Yeah.
70 years ago, what sort of memories are stirred by this anniversary for you?
You know, I got my first scare just before we landed in Normandy. We met with Eisenhower's staff, and they started talking to us. I'm 20 years old, and he starts talking to us, and he said, "You are the landing force. You are going in, and we expect 50% casualties." He says, "Look at the guy next to you. Either you or he is not coming back." You know, that's a hell of a scare at that age. You got a 50-50 chance of coming back.
I would say it is a hell of a scare. We did a program on Monday with the author of the book, and the title of the book was The Dead and Those Who Are About to Die, and that's what people like yourself were told.
Yeah.
What was your unit? What was your mission on D-Day?
Well, I was in the 110th AAA Battalion, and it was a 90-millimeter.
It's an anti-aircraft battalion, correct?
Yeah. But we were not going in as anti-aircraft. We were going in as artillery. We didn't know that till about the day before the invasion started that we were artillery and not anti-aircraft. And we had never been trained on artillery, but we learned fast.
I'll bet you did. You went in a couple of hours after the first wave, did you not?
Yeah, right.
Give me some sense of what you were seeing. I mean, you're all lined up and ready to go in, but you knew all hell was breaking loose on the beach.
Right. It was the Germans were shelling the beach. In fact, I was in A Battery, and one of their shells hit D Battery and scattered the landing craft that they were in. And these fellows... Well, you had 75-pound pack on your back. You had a rifle. You had all kinds of equipment you were carrying, and the May West vest, which was around your waist, and that was a big failure because when this got hit, these people were all top heavy, and all you saw is the back end of the people. They had drowned. And one of the sergeants in our group said, "Take a knife." And he told one of the other fellows, "Take a knife and get in the boat and go out there and puncture those May West vests." Well, they did. He said, "They'll sink to the bottom, and then tomorrow when the tide goes out, we can pick them up." Well, when the tide went out, they weren't there. They were floated into the river and gone. But... And then they woke up and decided that it's best if you put that May West vest under your arms instead of around your waist.
Well, some of them eventually did that, but an awful lot were lost.
Oh, yeah.
Did you have any recollection of what your thought process was as you were watching this happening, knowing that you had to go in eventually?
Well, as I said, when they told me 50-50, you know, I said... We got to go in. There's no use sitting here. We can't go backwards. We got to go forward, and let's go. You know, you got to do it. That's what you were trained for—to get in there and fight.
really had no choice. There's no place to run, even if you wanted to.
Even think about running or turning back.
We'll come back to that day and some of your experiences because they go far beyond the landing on D-Day. But I want to get some of the other folks here at the table into the conversation. Harris Gerhardt, you were not at Normandy. You were a flyboy.
Yes, sir.
Did you have any activity at all related to the Normandy invasion?
The only thing, our bomb group was the 446 bomb group, and they were the first ones over in the invasion. And the only thing about it, I always bragged about it, and if you go over there, they have the memorial over there, and they show how all of the landings were developed and the people and the divisions. The only thing is, we were told that they missed their target, and it wasn't the best thing in the world. So I'm not bragging about it anymore.
Well, that's one of the things I would have brought up eventually, is the fact that the Air Force or the air assault was not very effective on that day because the targets were so small, they were very difficult to hit, from what I understand. What is your recollection of what you were thinking? I mean, you knew ultimately that the invasion was taking place. Mm-hmm. What were your thoughts upon hearing that?
Well, I was just wanting to go over there rather than Japan. And when I was doing all my training in the States, so I really didn't get over there until November of of 43. Then
was it November
of 44?
November of 44. So you were obviously after some months after the invasion. So your activity was over the Europe and chasing the Germans back toward Berlin, if you will.
We went to every city you could think about that had some type of industry for the Germans to continue on with the war. Aircraft facilities, we bombed those, and the airfields and the tank factories, and just about everyone we could think of that they would get. And that was the thing we do, no matter if it was our one time. We went back twice to the same place because we missed it.
So, well, the B-24 was a formidable weapon, wasn't it?
It was, to me. Of course, I flew on a 24, but B-17s were very much, they were the first ones over there, and they took the brunt of it, really. But the 24 was a little larger, could go distance of 3,000 miles and against 4 one-ton bombs we could carry on it, which we did at one time.
Well, that pack was one heck of a wallop.
Yes, sir.
Dr. Despotis, you're listening to this. You're of a different generation, but you spent a lot of time interviewing people who were part of this effort. What are your thoughts and what recollections do you have from folks you've talked to about what they were thinking at the time?
Well, I guess you're referring to specifically D-Day.
Yeah, well, not necessarily. Certainly we'll start with that if we can.
Okay. Well, I would say that certainly it's been an honor to get to know each and every one of these individuals. And as you are well aware, you can't fight a war with all aspects, whether you're in the front lines or in the rear supplying the frontline soldiers. And so, again, I believe that all of them played an important role. I certainly have focused as part of our interviews on people that entered an ETO at the invasion.
European Theater of Operations.
That's right, and entered on D-Day, June 6th. And I would say that a resonating thing among those veterans is that, of course, there was trepidation on their part. They didn't know if they were going to survive, as Mr. Engel said. But also, I think duty was an important part of this, and I keep hearing from a lot of the interviews that they were most interested, especially if they were platoon leaders or they were officers or non-commissioned officers, that they wanted to make sure and get the right thing done, keep their guys alive if they could, achieve their objectives, and that's what they were focused in on. Of course, they were scared, but they knew that this was a pivotal moment in history, and they needed to be the vanguard of the crusade.
Clem, is that right? Were you very much aware of what this was all about?
I agree with him 100% what he's saying. Yes, that's what it was all about. We had to get, you know, everybody was in this together. We were all in this together. Everybody wasn't on the front line, but you had enough people on the front line to move it, you know. But there had to be a lot of planning and a lot of brains behind us, and they really came out. I think Eisenhower did an outstanding job with his staff and what they did and on down the line.
Dr. Despotis, there were some miscalculations, however, and I think Clem alluded to them with regard to the May vest, vests and that sort of thing. The weather certainly didn't cooperate in that day. Did you hear much about that in the people you talked to?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're but, you know, I would have to give the leaders credit where it's deserved. They frequently did have contingency plans. And so whether you're talking about trying to hit the Pointe du Hoc and knock out the 155s and the Ranger battalions, they also had another group of Ranger battalions that came in on the Dog Green sector of Omaha. And so had D Company not achieved their goal, they would have come inland, which was a much more difficult place to attack. They thought if they could scale the cliffs, they could take them out there. And so they always had contingencies, and yes, there were a lot of mistakes, and there were a lot of lives lost. But unfortunately, that's the nature of war, and it's not a pretty thing. But you know, when the price tag of freedom is at stake, these men came from all ranks, and a lot of them enlisted. They didn't wait to be drafted. They knew they had a mission in life, and this was to save our freedom and to maintain our freedom for future generations. And getting back to your question, I mean, I think even when people like Lenny Lamell, one of the Ranger leaders, and Mr. Kirchner got to the top and they couldn't find the 155s on Pointe du Hoc, they kept looking. They said, well, there must be somewhere. They kept looking, and eventually they found them in an apple grove there, and they destroyed those guns because they were going to bear down on those poor guys that were on the beach. And so there are countless missions like that they had to have contingency plans and follow through with that. Had they not, it would have been a different story.
I'm going to ask each of our guests before I take our first break the same question. I'll start with you, Doctor. What do you think of the term the greatest generation?
Well, I understand why Tom Brokaw named that as he did, because in all honesty, every World War II veteran that I've met, I deeply admire. I mean, they're clearly an important generation. And again, as I mentioned earlier, this was a critical moment in history. And, you know, it's almost like destiny in the sense, because this is a generation when they were young kids that were struggling through the Depression. It was almost like a deity was, in fact, preparing them for their great mission just a few years later.
Toughen them up.
Absolutely.
Toughen them up. Harris, what do you think about that phrase?
Well, of course, I was just growing up, just got out of high school and all that, and I was going to school to RSU and trying to get something going in the engineering department. And it got to the point where I thought I should join. And, of course, I was always interested in flying, so I joined the aviation cadet program. And, then that was a thing, and to have all the people today still around, it's something else. It's a great generation. They're still around here to help.
Did you feel at the time, and all of this was happening, that you were part of a special group somehow?
I don't think we did then, but the more and more, because our airplane had 10 members on it. And each of us now, after we were discharged, and we always kept in touch. We always had the family go along with us, and so it made a very, very, very good friendship. And we were proud of that membership.
Well, and with great justification, I should add. Clem, what about you? The phrase "the greatest generation."
Well, I think it has to be. We worked hard to get the war over as soon as we can with the fewest casualties we can, and we needed everybody. I was talking about those airplanes. If they didn't drop a bomb, if they just were up there, it was good for morale. I don't care where they were. Well, you'd see 1,000 B-17s heading for Germany, and man, that you would really sit up and appreciate what they're doing. And you wonder about all the jobs that people had behind you. But you had to move on.
Including those back at home, including the women, the Rosie the Riveters, and the people who were making those planes possible.
Oh, yeah. We didn't lack anything. The Germans did. And, you know, Hitler needed gasoline, and he couldn't get gasoline, and we had more gasoline than we know what to do with. We had a vehicle that pulled those 90-millimeter guns. It held 300 gallons of gasoline, and it got less than a mile a gallon. So these people back here had, you know, didn't have all the gasoline they wanted. But we were sure using it, and it was there.
It was severely rationed at that time. I certainly know that. We have to take a break now. I want to have you two gentlemen here get into a conversation about how you looked at each other during those days of final days of World War II, and we'll do that in just a moment. We're talking about actually the greatest generation, some of the men who were involved in the war effort, particularly D-Day and the assault on Europe following D-Day. We'll continue that conversation in a moment. Clem Igle is a World War II veteran. He landed on D-Day. You just heard from him. Dr. George Despotis is a co-author of Victory Through Valor. It's a series of oral histories of World War II vets. And Harris Gerhardt was a B-24 bomber flight engineer who flew 32 missions over Europe during the final 6 months of the war. We'll come back to continue this hot conversation. If you'd like to be a part of it, we'd love to hear from you. 382-8255 is our number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd prefer to send a tweet, do that at STL on air. This is St. Louis on the air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. As all of you know, I'm sure tomorrow marks the 70th anniversary of the Allied invasion at Normandy. We're talking about that today, and we're talking about, we'll also be talking about the days that followed that invasion. With me in studio is Clem Igle, World War II veteran. He landed at D-Day. Dr. George Despotis is co-author of Victory Through Valor, a series of oral histories of men who went through that and other battles during World War II. Also with me in studio is Harris Gerhardt, a B-24 bomber flight engineer during the final days of the war. Clem and Harris, I'd like the two of you to just talk about how you viewed each other, not personally, but the Air Force versus the folks on the ground. During the days of war and the days that you saw combat, Clem, you had indicated that you were certainly reassured by seeing fellow like Harris here fly by.
You know, we couldn't have done it alone, and they were just to see or hear 1,000 B-17s go overhead is a morale. You want to go forward. They're helping you, and you got to help them. You just can't do things alone. You got to have cooperation, and they sure did a good job for us. You know, as I said, if they didn't drop a bomb, if they just flew overhead, you felt better.
And Harris, did you feel better because you were in the air and not having to dig a foxhole?
I sure was. I'll tell you, it was a nice warm bed at night when we'd go home and have good food. But I'll tell you, I always thought of those people down there, and we could see the action that was going on. And a personal friend of mine, he always said the same thing, Harris. He said, we sure loved to see you. He said, when we were in a foxhole and it was colder than hell, and I said, well, listen, it was colder than hell up there, too. Because we were up at some 30,000 feet, and if we didn't keep warm, and we would be in real trouble too. So,
any sense of rivalry between the foot soldier and the flyboys?
Oh, never. You really never.
I don't remember. We didn't come in contact personally with them.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
We were in Europe on the ground, and they were in England and on the ground there. We didn't know.
You know, maybe I've seen too many movies, but it seems to me there are those occasions where the two would meet in a pub or some place like that and get to perhaps showing that there was a rivalry between the two groups.
I never saw it. I never heard of it.
I don't think when we got into And I know they didn't get into London, and we got into London every six missions. We'd give a little break and weekends. And it was mostly you would have a little rivalry between a B-24 and a 17 because the 24 really took over for the 17, which really took the brunt of it because they didn't have the firepower and they didn't have the bomb loads that we were carrying. And that was the thing that we
sort of a natural rivalry. There was
naturally.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about, Harris, is the fact that I was under the impression that the number of missions was capped at 25 in the European theater. You flew 32.
Yes. Well, of course, I was at the end of the war. It really was 25, but that was in the B-17s that went up 25 because they had the real hard time. They didn't get to the altitudes that we did. There were more German fighters around, and of course that's when we came into the picture. That's some of the things that we were trying to do is get rid of some of those. I have a list here of how many missions in there, and like airfields to get rid of that. We went to three of them. Oil refineries, six. And when we got marshaling yards, those were where all the railroad cars were, like we call the freight yards. And tank factories, two of them. It was something that we had to do, and we even dropped propaganda leaflets. Now, that is something just for – not all the ships were doing it, but we were doing this. And ammunition plants and railroad bridges. And that's when I was talking about a bridge. We went back the second time because we missed it the first time.
Well, I want to talk about one bridge in particular, but Dr. Despotis said, let me go to you. What can you tell us about the bridge I'm thinking about, the bridge at Remagen? Who have you talked to with regard to that particular situation?
Well, ironically, you know, most of the interviews really didn't focus on that particular instance. Now, I know that was obviously a major point, actually, one of the veterans that I know very well, Mr. Charlie Ryan, was part of the 2nd Ranger Battalion, and he was actually with the 78th at the time. But he specifically remembers at the bridge where I think it was a couple days around his birthday in the first week of March, and lo and behold, you look up and he sees this this jet. Which he had never seen a jet before, and it came in and it bombed the bridge in an attempt to stall the U.S. advance. And so that's one specific remembrance I have of one of the interviews with Mr. Ryan.
That bridge was strategically very important. It was a railroad bridge.
Absolutely.
And it was the only surviving bridge over the Rhine within a couple of hundred miles and very, very important for us to be able to go north. And very important for the Germans to defend. But I want to come back to Clem because you were there.
Yeah, I was at the bridge. We were defending the bridge. The Germans tried everything possible to destroy the bridge, and our job was to keep that bridge open. And we were on the We were in Germany. We had gone over the bridge, but we had to keep it open and keep it intact for the rest of the troops to get over with us.
You certainly recognized its importance.
Oh, yes, yes. It was the only one that really could handle a lot of traffic. You know, these pontoon bridges are great. They can take a few infantry people across them, but they can't take the army over it.
Or tanks or heavy equipment. That was why this one was so important,
yeah.
As I understand, because tanks could use it. They couldn't use the pontoon bridges quite so well.
Right.
And how active was the action there? As you say, you were defending the bridge.
I think there were 10 battalions of anti-aircraft there, and the most anti-aircraft anywhere in the war were all there, trying to defend that bridge. We were all firing, and Eisenhower kept the ammunition coming, and we were all out. To defend, and as I said, I was on the German side. Why should I worry about a bridge behind me? Well, I did. I worried about it because we had to get more troops and more everything and go to Berlin.
What were some of the tricks that the Germans used to try to knock that bridge up?
Well, they tried planes, and we drove all the planes off. And then they dropped bombs up the river from the bridge and hoped they would float down and destroy the bridge. They tried everything imaginable to destroy that bridge.
Harris, how difficult is it at 30,000 feet to hit a bridge?
It's not difficult, but it's just the matter of location and being on target and not being an overcast day or something like that. Because we were bombing later on with radar.
How much awareness did you have, being in the air and being part of this operation in the air, of the strategic targets? You mentioned oil fields and airports and that sort of thing. Were you fully aware of the strategic importance of the targets that you were sent after?
Not really. I didn't really know the importance, and I started reading in a book, Masters of the Air. I don't know if you've met it, read it, and because it's a very, very a book that will give you all the details of how we went about doing all of this from the air. And of course, the big thing with our being in the air, it wasn't all as neat as some people think. You had a lot of anti-aircraft flak, we called it, and that sure, when we start going over a target, while we knew it, and all you had to do is just get one burst, and you got 10 men were gone. And I've read figures where there were more people killed in the Air Force than even the Marine Corps over in.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I'd never heard that.
It is very. You know, you just don't think about it. I was a 21-year-old, and I didn't think anything was going to happen to me, and that's the way I felt. And I had a crew that we all worked together, and a nice group. And the thing about it was, when we got up in the morning at 3 o'clock, we knew we were going to fly and go down, and they would go into a room, and then they dropped the map down, and then they showed you your mission for that day, and that it could be an 8-hour mission, and you're relying on heated suits, you're relying on your oxygen, you're relying on everything on that aircraft, and if anything ever happened, they'd say, "Well, Harris, get back there and fix it." Well, like we had, you got to get rid of all your bombs when you were flying, and we had them racked up, and so I took an oxygen mask and disconnected my heated suit and went out onto a 6-inch to 8-inch runway, but in the bomb bay, we keep the doors open and try to break those bombs loose, because we couldn't take them back, and you can't, you know, you don't want it. So I finally broke them loose and sent them down so that we could close up that. And it's things like that we had to do up there, and it's not quite as much just work as they did on the ground, though.
What about the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe?
We were late in the war, I would say, because when I first got there, or the first mission was in November of 30 in 1944. And we run into a lot of them, yes. They would sit up there in the sun, and then they would dive down. But we were finally relieved by having the P-51s come in with fuel tanks. They could carry us on into the German territory much easier, and was protection.
Refueling in the air, is that what you're saying?
No, they didn't fuel. They were carrying extra fuel in those belly tanks.
Oh, I see. Okay.
They had a much longer extended range.
Yeah,
that made a huge difference in the air war.
Yeah. Well, what can you tell us about the air war with regard, with regard to the people that you've talked to?
Well, I mean, it's like any aspect of war. You know, I remember Mr. Bob Sullivan. He was a waist gunner in the Pacific in a B-24. I remember several people talking about their missions. And, you know, everybody thinks, well, you're either killed or you're not. But there are a lot of things that happen. Like Mr. Sullivan, he had several crash landings in the Pacific. And he, after the war, had to have rods placed up and down his spine just to even walk. And the man had disability the rest of his life. And he never had anybody complain about that. That's just something they served and they did it. And that's the price tag on freedom. And so, you know, the... talking about the air war, I mean, it's he's exactly right in terms, Mr. Gerhardt, in terms of there were tremendous losses, especially until that P-51 got in there, because they didn't have fighter support into the inner part of Germany, and a lot of men lost, and a lot of men shot up in battle too. So it's I'm not sure where's a good place to be in war. They all suffered in many different ways, and when you lose a part of your crew, you'll never forget that.
And if a plane goes down, you lose everybody. You lose 10 at a time as opposed to one
at a time. That's the other thing. We had our rudder cables shut out at one time, and we had to land in an emergency field. And it was really a German field that had just been evacuated. And so we landed. That was in Bruges, Belgium. And we landed on a field that was really built for fighter jets that the Germans were building. And it was a lot lighter aircraft compared to what we did. And when we landed, we kind of tore up the thing. So it wasn't very good to get the airplane back into the air after we spent the night there, though.
That's one of the reasons why you don't want to land with a bunch of bombs in your belly, right?
Well, that's another thing. Yes, you don't.
Something else.
You can't do that because you got to leave the doors open, or if you leave the doors open and the freezing conditions are there, the bombs go through the doors and they're hanging open, and then you can't land the airplane.
Just something else to think about when everything else is going on. I have to take another break, gentlemen. We'll do that now. We are talking about the final phases of World War II. This is really in observance of tomorrow's anniversary, of the 70th anniversary of the landing at D-Day. I have with me in studio Clem Eigel, who is a veteran of that D-Day landing. He is a World War II veteran, obviously, who served well during his time in that conflict. Dr. George Despotis is with us. He's written a book, a co-author of a book called Victory Through Valor. Had a lot of oral histories, that is, of veterans who fought in World War II, including many from this area. Harris Gerhardt, from whom you just heard, was a B-24 bomber flight engineer during the final phases of World War II. We'll come back, continue our conversation, and if you'd like to get into it, give us a call at 382-8255, that's 382-TALK, or send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue our conversation about World War II with some of the gentlemen, some of the members of the Greatest Generation who fought in it. With me in studio is Clem Eigel. He landed at D-Day. Harris Gerhardt, B-24 bomber flight engineer, also with us. Both of these gentlemen, by the way, I should have mentioned earlier, are area residents. Harris, you're from Webster Groves?
Correct.
And Clem Baldwin, is that correct?
All right. Hi.
Good. Well, we're glad to have you with us. And Dr. Despotis, a number of the people that you talked to were area veterans as well, for all branches of service?
That's correct. In fact, I'd have to say that the collaboration was with the veterans of the Battle of the Bulge organization here in St. Louis, which at a time had 300 or 400 members, and obviously that's much less now. But they collaborated with me, and I guess part of my experience with the veterans is frequently you would try to interview veterans, but they really weren't interested in talking because they obviously were tragic moments, or in no way did they want to brag about their service. But I think it's through the cooperation of the VBOB group in here in St. Louis that I was able to get the whole organization to buy in the concept that we would do this as a group. We'd all band together and get our stories out and keep it for future generations. And so that's how that worked out.
I've interviewed many World War II veterans over the years, the 50th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor and anniversary of the end of the war. And I've said to people here that I never interviewed a veteran who saw combat who didn't at some point weep during the conversation. Did you find that?
Well, I think that's probably true. And whether they displayed it physically or not, you could tell there were agony. There were agonizing moments in the interview. And you don't have to have a physical tear to know that they were suffering from. In fact, a gentleman from Mr. Eigel's group, Elmer Potsman, who I believe you know, Mr. Potsman continued to have nightmares. He was a medic on D-Day on the Dog Green sector of Omaha, where they came in together. And I'll tell you, every week or two, the rest of his life, he had nightmares about what he had experienced.
Yes, he did.
The tragedy on that beachhead, he was trying to help so many different guys, and there's no way he could help any of them in a sense. So absolutely.
The book that I mentioned before, The Dead and Those Who Are About to Die, spent a lot of time talking about the medics, and I cannot even begin to describe the bravery, I mean, the impression of what these young men were doing to help save lives. Incredible.
Well, Elmer Potsman was outstanding. I mean, he couldn't stand to see a guy yelling medic. He had to help him, and he made his own splints and everything out of tree limbs and everything. He was outstanding all the time.
Clem, are you able to keep your emotions in check when you think back on those days?
Well, I try to. I mean, sometimes it gets hard to, but yeah.
So. Doing a pretty good job at it today. How about you, Harris?
Not really. Not in the past, but now I think about it very often. And I have a flight jacket that I wore during the war, and in fact, our airplane was called the Battle Dragon, and it was painted on a side, which I did with another one of our members, and on the jacket. But all my 10 friends or 9 friends are gone, and you think about them, especially when you used to have meetings with them every 5 years, and you were there with their families and everything, and you got to know them well.
Sure. Go ahead.
It is a very sad motion. And I know I've thought of these people on the ground more and more because, as I say, I played golf with a fellow that was in a foxhole, and he told me how he appreciated seeing those bombers come over, and I said, well, I even kidded him. I said, well, at least we used to get a warm bed.
But, you know, I suppose there's a special bond amongst people who fight together such as you did and
you
have to count on each other for survival.
Yes.
I imagine that's true.
But everybody has to work together.
Yes.
I want to talk a little bit about the Battle of the Bulge. And Dr. Despotis, I'll ask you to kind of set this up for us, and Clem can tell us about his own experiences there. Not everyone knows what that was all about, but tell us what it was.
Well, I agree with you. Not everybody knows, and it's really a shame because from my perspective, it's probably one of the largest, if not the largest, U.S. battle. I mean, it involved nearly 1 million men when it's all said and done, and on both sides. But the scope and the relative background of this is we're talking about mid-December 1944. We're talking about a little bit of a lull in the fighting. We have probably about a 110-mile front along the Belgian border there. And we have 4 U.S. divisions, a couple of them experienced, a couple not, on the line, which is fairly thinly spread for that kind of front. And then you have a couple divisions in the background. So it's about December 16th, and this was a plan that the Axis powers put together, in specific Nazi Germany, to really cut the U.S. and English forces in half. And they were waiting for an opportune time in terms of no air support because they wanted cloudy, because at the time, obviously, the U.S. Commanded the air. And so they attacked on 3 major prongs, these forces, and they attacked in much greater strength. We're talking maybe 40 to 50,000 of our men with the 6 divisions on the ground. You're talking a force of maybe 300,000 German forces, and we're talking in the range of probably 1,400 tanks with 30 divisions, and they came in strength. They weren't suppressed at all by the Army Air Corps, and they ran through a number of lines. But and so that was the scope. And the other thing is that it was severe winter conditions, probably one of the coldest conditions in Europe for many years. And so the U.S. forces were not only battling the German forces, but also severe weather conditions where you can get frostbite very easily. And so now you have this attack, and again, we turned the tide in that whole thing. It was because a number of heroic events, whether it be small or large unit actions, that came about, and there were divisions, and there were small outfits, like Lyle Bach was an INR platoon commander at the top of a little town at Landsberg, and his INR platoon of 15 guys held back the whole German column, Colonel Piper, for nearly a day. And they thought they had a battalion up there, and they had 15 guys, and they were well fortified on the top of the hill. But they took out nearly a battalion-sized group of German military. And those type of small unit actions is what stopped this. But all through this 40-day front, these guys suffered not only from the shelling but the severe weather conditions. And at the same time, it was probably close to 20,000 fatalities, if not a lot more, in terms of overall effects of the battle. So it was a huge battle and a huge turning point.
It should be mentioned too that the Germans were highly motivated because this was an act of desperation. They had to win there in order to save whatever was left of their country.
Well, that's right, because if they could separate the U.S. and the British forces, they could sue for peace and try to have some negotiations. Otherwise, they were going to lose everything. And so they knew. You're absolutely right. But it was, there were a number of reasons, but the U.S. immediately mobilized two airborne divisions and got them in there very quickly and stopped the gaps. And again, more harrowing events by a number of outfits. Mr. Clarence Goldsmith was part of the 82nd, was mobilized from France immediately. Within one day, was on the ground fighting, and they fought aggressively and recaptured a number of towns. First got the presidential unit citation for capturing one of the first towns in there. But the U.S. responded immediately and curbed that attack. And it's a bulge because if you look at the map, it's curtailed in a sense. So
sure. Well, let's turn to Clem now. I'm sure what you just heard has brought back some memories. What do you recall, and what was your role at the Battle of the Bulge?
Well, our role at the Battle of the Bulge was to keep that Remagen Bridge open. And I think there were at least a battalion or two or three down there trying to defend that bridge. Everybody you talked to, they said, we got to defend it. And we were, it was snow, as I said. It was 24 below or something like that, and 3 foot of snow, and trucks couldn't get food to you. We lived off the K rations for quite a while down there.
I didn't realize that the bridge at Remagen and the defense of that was actually considered part of the Battle of the Bulge.
Well, I think it was because
you were there.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the whole front, I think some people have said the whole front was 500 feet long, from it ran from Switzerland to the English Channel or what?
I'm sure you didn't mean 500 feet, but probably.
No, I didn't mean 500 feet.
Doctor, you say 110 miles?
I believe approximately.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable.
Right. And how long were you there?
What?
At Remagen and part of this, all of this?
Oh, I don't know. We were there when the Battle of Bulge started on December the 16th. And we were there, I don't know, we defended that bridge and hoping to get more troops over onto German soil because that's what we had to do.
Sure.
You had to get
sure.
the troops over to
right.
into Germany. And you had Patton, he's running like a tiger, You can't keep up with him.
Yeah, he was very much on the move, no question about that. And Harris, you were shut out of that particular part of it because of, as the doctor has just indicated,
the weather was bad. We were down for 6 days. Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
I want to bring.
Although we did get up and dropped food to them and ammunition because they were so far out of the lines that they weren't getting them.
No wonder he's so grateful to people like you. I want to take a quick call here because a question relates to. Dr. Despotis' book, I believe. Richard in St. Louis, go ahead.
Thank you, and my respects to Clint. You're probably as old as some of my uncles, and you tell a better description than they did. But for Dr. Versudis, the Judge Theodore McMillan, a very important St. Louis federal judge who passed away 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, he was a St. Louis University graduate, and he entered the Army and he became an officer. And my understanding is he was an intelligence officer with one of the groups at the Remagen Bridge. And I'm wondering, even though Judge McMillan is no longer living, whether in your book you included either his some of his memories or some of the his recollections that the McMillan family have.
Well, to answer your question, unfortunately, I don't have any information on him. And really, most of our information was obtained from the veterans we interviewed, which were numbered over 100, and the majority were in the St. Louis area. And I'm sure he would have served in a tremendous fashion there. It's just we're very limited in the sense of what we were typically just trying to obtain the personal accounts of these individuals because we know the typical battle plans and what happened. But what we don't have is what they experienced and the hardships and the tragedies of war and the camaraderie. And so I wish we could have had his accounts, but we didn't, to answer your question.
I think he's referring to Judge Theodore McMillan, who did pass away. Brief time. Very little time left. Did you talk to Jack Buck at all? I know he was wounded in the Battle of Vulture.
You're right. I have not. In fact, he was at our hospital in his last days, but I wish I would have. But I know he was at Remagen, and he got hit there. And
He told some interesting stories about all of that. In the time we have left, Clem, I'll start with you. What about after the war? What did you do after the war? That was 70 years ago we're talking about.
We had the GI Bill, and I went to Washington U and got an electrical engineering degree.
And did you have your own business?
No, I worked for AT&T, and I didn't do much electrical engineering. It was in management, and that kept me busy.
How many years were you with AT&T?
40 years.
Right. Harris, how about you? What did you do after the war?
Well, I went to school, too, and then I got a job with a company that made diesel engines, and it was called Bushelzer Diesel Engine Company, which was owned partly by the Bush family.
Good German name.
And I started out there, and that's where I got started, and went back there and stayed there for 30 years.
Wow.
And was a sales engineer and have worked with all the large companies, Procter & Gamble. And
that's the story.
That they have, yes.
Yeah.
It's just to the point that you get old, you don't remember as much as you think.
Really? Tell me about it. Doctor, very briefly, you're involved with a wartime recreation group, and you're having something at the Science Center tomorrow, an event of some sort?
That's absolutely right. I'm part of the 2nd Ranger Battalion reenactor organization here in St. Louis, and really our mission is to try to educate current and future generations as to the sacrifices of that generation. And in fact, you're absolutely right. There is a big event commemorating the 70th anniversary at the Science Center. I would urge people to come. We're going to have military vehicles, people dressed in the uniforms, and a lot of the veterans will be there to tell their stories as well.
We'll have information on that on our website.
Dr.
George Despotis, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Harris Gerhart, thank you for being with us. And Clem Eichel, thank you. Thank you so much for your service. We owe so much to people like you. Thank you. Thank you. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape when he'll talk about Hitana Productions' Fiesta of Latin and African American Music, about Webster Art and Air Festival, and also take a look at PhD Gallery's new exhibition of selfies taken by 50 prominent St. Louisans, also details surrounding the return of a stopwatch. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is produced by Mary Edwards, Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Camille Phillips, Kyle Jacoby, and Spencer Reed. Thank you so much for listening, all. I'm Don Marsh.